I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Musician Michelle Zauner had a complicated relationship with her South Korean-born mother, torn between rebelling against her mother's demands and feeling a desperate need to please her. She was not what Zauner called a mommy mom, who fretted over her child's every move and every mood. It was more a tough love, with food the source of their bond and an expression of her mother's devotion. When her mother was diagnosed with cancer in 2014, Michelle Zauner moved from Philadelphia, where she was living, back to Oregon to take care of her mother. Her new memoir, Crying in H-Mart, is about grief and loss, memory and identity, and food, lots of food. H-Mart is a South Korean supermarket chain where she and her mother used to shop. Zauner would find herself crying in the aisles, surrounded by the foods her mother used to cook, feeling alone and unmoored. Michelle Zauner performs under the name Japanese Breakfast. She's got a new album coming out in June called Jubilee. And she joins us on Radio Times to talk about her memoir, her mother, music, and food. Lots of food, Michelle Zauner. It's a great pleasure. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for writing this book and, frankly, allowing us strangers, us readers, into your life. Was it a hard book to write?
It was a hard book to write, but it was also, I learned so many things from it and took so much away from the process.
Well, I'd love to have you read from the very beginning of the book, which actually was an essay that was in The New Yorker just a couple of years ago, but just to get our conversation started.
Sure. Ever since my mom died, I cry in H-Mart. H-Mart is a supermarket chain that specializes in Asian food. The H stands for hanarim, a Korean phrase that roughly translates to one armful of groceries. H-Mart is where parachute kids flock to find the brand of instant noodles that reminds them of home. It's where Korean families buy rice cakes to make tteokguk, the beef and rice cake soup that brings in the new year. It's the only place where you can find a giant vat of peeled garlic, because it's the only place that truly understands how much garlic you'll need for the kind of food your people eat. H-Mart is freedom from the single-aisle ethnic section in regular grocery stores. They don't prop goya beans next to bottles of sriracha here. Instead, you'll likely find me crying by the banchan refrigerators, remembering the taste of my mom's soy sauce eggs and cold radish soup, or in the freezer section, holding a stack of dumpling skins, thinking of all the hours that Mom and I spent at the kitchen table folding minced pork and chives into the thin dough, sobbing near the dry goods, asking myself, am I even Korean anymore if there's no one left to call and ask which brand of seaweed we used to buy?
Well, I love that beginning of the book. And do you still cry in H-Mart?
I do still cry in H-Mart sometimes.
But you also say, I mean, it's what, been 7 years, not that it, you know, it doesn't get easier, I think, when a parent dies, but nonetheless, we still miss them. Is it still a place full of sort of memories and smells and tastes for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a, you know, it's become sort of like this holy refuge for me in a way. And I certainly don't cry as much as I used to, but sometimes there'll be something that just strikes a chord in me. Usually it's when I see another Korean mom sort of doting on her kid and preparing them to go to college or, go off for the weekend somewhere, making sure they have enough ramen and microwavable rice and, and watching that always sort of hurts me in a way. But, you know, I think of her very fondly, and there's a lot of things in H-Mart that makes me smile as well.
And those happy memories as well. But, you know, taste and smell, those are such a, as Proust knew, you know, such a powerful way of taking us back to really intense, strong childhood memories.
Certainly, yeah. I think that for me, so much of my memory of my mom was rooted in trauma initially, because the caretaking process can be rather horrific. And for, you know, it was the last concentrated period of time I spent with my mother. And for a long time, I couldn't remember her before we went through chemotherapy and before she, you know, her health began to deteriorate. And going to H-Mart sort of helped me to sort of begin to uncover memories of my childhood that were, you know, memories I could look back on fondly and not with sort of horror.
Sure. And memories because of the taste and the smell of foods, right?
Certainly, yeah. And my childhood, and just nostalgic, you know, snacks that I ate that she packed for me when I went to school, or things we ate in the summertime. And, you know, that would sort of lead to, you know, what dress she would wear on the patio. And, you know, they were all sort of locked together in a way.
You know, I was thinking, because you are a musician, that music really does the same thing. I mean, you'll hear a song that you might have heard when you were 12 or 14 years old, and gosh, that just hearing it again doesn't transport us back to that time.
Definitely. I think they're both sort of universal languages in a way.
What did food mean to your mother? I mean, it seems like it meant everything, but what did it mean to her?
I think for a long time I didn't realize that it meant... it was her way of interacting with her home country. You know, I think that as a kid, I didn't. My mom, you know, never let on that. At times, I'm sure she felt homesick. She moved to the U.S. when she was in her 30s and left her entire family behind to start this new family with my father and I. And I think she never wanted to let on that there were times that she missed her family and her home, because she didn't want us to be concerned or feel like she didn't want to be there with us. And I think that eating this way just made her comfortable and comforted. And reminded her of home.
And she would cook two dinners, right? One for your dad, her husband, who actually was American born in Philadelphia, and another meal for you and her?
Yeah, I would kind of get to have the best of both worlds. So I remember frequently we would have a table where my dad would have like salmon with asparagus, where my mom would have like a, you know, like a bubbling jjigae with like, you know, different side dishes. And if I felt like eating steak that night with my dad, I would have bites of steak, and then I would have, you know, spoonfuls of stew if I wanted to. So I had a very charmed relationship with food, and got to interact with the sort of best of both worlds whenever I felt like it.
Your dad was, or, you know, was, he's still around, is from Philadelphia. In fact, he answered an ad in the Philadelphia Inquirer, and that's how he ended up in South Korea.
Yes, I guess there was some cryptic ad in the Inquirer that just read opportunity abroad, and that brought him to South Korea to sell used cars to the military.
Oh, wow. And you were born there in Seoul, correct?
I was born there in Seoul. My parents met in Seoul. She worked at the hotel, at the Neja Hotel, where he stayed. And the two of them got together, and they traveled to Germany, and they lived in Heidelberg for a few years, and they lived in Misawa, Japan for a couple years. And they were trying to get pregnant for all of those years, and it wasn't until they returned to Seoul that they were able to have me.
And you grew up in Oregon, and in part in what sounded like an actual woods. I mean, outside of the urban life and in the woods with your parents.
Yeah, I had a wonderful upbringing that was, you know, both charmed and I guess problematic in that way, where, you know, I grew up in the majestic woods of the Pacific Northwest. My parents lived on 5 acres of forest. It was very private and very beautiful. But, you know, when you're a kid, you just get really lonely. There's no neighboring children. You can't walk to any convenience stores. There's not much freedom. So, yeah, it was simultaneously very charmed and frustrating.
You were, I'm always hesitant to talk about only children, because there's something about that word only, as if there's something missing. But did you feel like there was something missing as a only child of your parents?
Growing up, I enjoyed being an only child. It certainly comes with a lot of privilege, but it was also, you know, it put a lot of pressure on my parents and our relationship, because we were all that we had. And my parents were often this sort of united force against me, and I didn't have anyone in my team to sort of combat them.
The two against one problem, right?
Yes, yeah.
Well, I'd love to actually have you read another section from your book. This is on the bottom of 17, and it's about your mother's, her brand of love.
Hers was tougher than tough love. It was brutal, industrial strength, a sinewy love that never gave way to an inch of weakness. It was a love that saw what was best for you 10 steps ahead and didn't care if it hurt like hell in the meantime. When I got hurt, she felt it so deeply. It was as though it were her own affliction. She was guilty only of caring too much. I realize this now only in retrospect. No one in this world would ever love me as much as my mother, and she would never let me forget it. Stop crying. Save your tears for when your mother dies. This was a common proverb in my household. In place of the English idioms my mother never learned, she coined a few of her own. Mommy is the only one who would tell you the truth because mommy is the only one who ever truly loved you. Some of the earliest memories I can recall are of my mother instructing me to always save 10% of yourself. What she meant was that no matter how much you thought you loved someone or thought they loved you, you never gave all of yourself. Save 10%, always, so there was something to fall back on. Even from daddy, I save, she would add.
Do you do that? Do you save 10% for yourself?
I think that I am not as great as you know, the sort of stoic withholding that my mother was. But I do try to keep it in mind, and I do think I save some things.
I mean,
maybe 5%.
Right. Still a saver, but not quite as much as your mother. But it's interesting to have a mother to say to their child, no one loves you as much as I do. I mean, that's a really, I don't know if it's burdensome, but a powerful thing to say to a kid.
Yeah, I mean, I think it made me a stronger person in a way. When I was younger, it was a sentiment that I didn't fully understand. And now as an adult, I can look back on and appreciate the value of.
You also write, my mother loved you not through white lies and constant verbal affirmations, but in subtle observations of what brought you joy, pocketed away to make you feel comforted and cared for even without realizing it. She remembered if you liked your stews with extra broth, if you were sensitive to spice, if you hated tomatoes, if you didn't eat seaweed, if you had a large appetite. So she was watchful. And it seemed like when it came to eating, that was the sort of real joy that you had with your mother in the family without all the rules and demands.
Certainly, yeah. We approached food with so much joy, and one thing I really love about my mother is that she chased her cravings. So we never meal prepped or anything. We always let the weather or the type of day inspire us with what to eat, and so it was always like a fun activity to share with one another.
What were some of the favorite things you liked to make with your mother?
I remember making, to make dumplings together was always such a process. You know, you have this sort of assembly line of making dumplings. Or I remember when I went to Korean school every Friday, she would sometimes make kimbap, which is like kind of like a Korean sushi. It's like a rice roll with different vegetables. And it's also a sort of assembly line process where we, you know, put all the different vegetables inside and would roll them up together. And there are these colorful little coins. I have so many memories of eating with her that I think back on so fondly.
Well, it's making my mouth water. Well, I'll tell you what, Michelle, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Michelle Zauner is our guest today on Radio Time. She's got a new memoir called Crying in H Mart. It's about her relationship with her mother who died back in 2014 after getting a diagnosis of cancer. Michelle Zauner also performs under the name Japanese Breakfast, and we're going to play some of her music on Radio Times as well. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with musician Michelle Zauner about her new memoir, Crying in H Mart. It's about her mother's death, their complicated relationship, food, family, identity, and music. And as I mentioned, Michelle Zauner performs under the name Japanese Breakfast. And here's a song from her forthcoming album, Jubilee. It's called Posing in Bondage. Let's give it a quick listen.
This way alone for hours.
And that's our guest, Japanese Breakfast's latest single, Posing in Bondage, off her forthcoming album. It's called Jubilee. And Michelle, there's a line in there, those who had felt pain and those who had yet to. This is from a new album, Jubilee, which of course is a very joyful sounding album. And the cover certainly has a joyful image of you. And I think it's a bunch of persimmons. What is this song about?
Well, that line is another line that actually makes an appearance in the book. And it was a sentiment that I felt really deeply after my mom passed away, where, you know, even though grief is such a challenge, it does open you up in this way. I feel like a more compassionate person. And, you know, after she passed away, I felt like I could connect to those who had sort of crossed over into this experience of grief in this way that I hadn't been able to before. And so that's what that line means.
I mean, we're in a time of profound international grief with the pandemic. I mean, here in the United States, more than 500,000 people have died because of COVID. So it's, you know, it's a really grief-filled time, I think, that we're all living in, whether you know someone who's died of COVID or not.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I feel like I'm able to, you know, it's a horrific time. But in some ways, I feel like when you experience that, I mean, I feel like I've been able to experience some more compassion for those who are dealing with these types of feelings in a way.
You write about music was really a way of what creating your own kind of world within your parents' world. What was some of the music you listened to as a kid growing up?
When I was a kid growing up, I listened to a lot of sort of Pacific Northwest indie rock bands like Modest Mouse and Built to Spill and Death Cab for Cutie, Elliott Smith. Those were my sort of heroes growing up.
And what did your parents listen to? Or did they?
My parents, growing up, didn't listen to that much music. I think my father had a few sort of Motown compilations in his car and, you know, liked Fleetwood Mac, but, you know, it wasn't a huge important thing in my household.
And you write about in this book, you're very honest about a number of things that happened with you and happened within your family, including you describe it as a kind of nervous breakdown that you had in high school. What was going on?
I think I just was a very sensitive child and I'm still a very sensitive person. And I think I just didn't know how to channel that type of energy at that age. And, you know, like most teenagers was, you know, being really confronted by my hormonal shift. But yeah, I just... I'd always been a great student, and then one morning I just sort of woke up and found myself unable to focus on anything or find a real will to challenge myself and continue working. And I think a big part of that went hand in hand with my interest in my sort of blossoming interest in music and creativity. And suddenly, the only thing that really felt important to me was art, and I think I sort of began to have this existential crisis of, you know, what is the point of doing all this? Why am I obsessing over schoolwork when the only thing that is permanent is art?
And your parents, as you watched this, what was their reaction?
Well, my mother certainly felt like it was a direct attempt to spite her instead of something that I was sort of mentally grappling with. And I think that she just felt it was her duty to sort of try to fix it, you know, in this way that I think as an immigrant parent, she didn't quite know how to handle.
Because just living in America, so far away from her family, in a culture so different from her own, how she grew up.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, my mom never really took me to the doctor. Like, going to the doctor was not a big thing in my household. So similarly, she wouldn't have really thought to take me to a therapist at that time. And that was really hard for her to wrap her head around. I think it's also a generational thing. I think both of my parents were sort of just like, you know, we've given you everything. Get it together.
Yeah, something the parents have said to many teenagers growing up. Were you a bad kid?
I would like to believe that I was maybe not as bad as my mother and my mother made me out to be. But I certainly had a major independent streak and was definitely rebelling in my adolescence in a major way.
She said a shocking thing to you, which is that you were such a bad kid. She had an abortion because you were such a bad kid.
Yeah, I think
that, I have to say I was... My jaw just dropped to imagine what that was like for you.
Yeah, it was a surprising thing to hear from my mother. I mean, I was certainly being very difficult during that time and had put my parents through so much at that age and was acting out in a major way. And I think she had just reached her wit's end and wanted to sort of hurl the most hurtful thing that she could think of. And I think certainly she didn't really blame me for that. But I'm sure that it played a role. I think, you know, in retrospect, something that my aunt said to me was that she thought that she did that because it would have been too difficult for her to bring two children on these biannual trips to Korea. And that was so important to her. And, you know, I was a very demanding child. I was certainly not easy as a child and as a teenager. Throughout my whole life, I was a somewhat difficult kid. And so I think that it came from a place of real hurt and anger when she said that.
Yeah, I can imagine. You did make these trips back to South Korea to see parts of her family, to meet your grandmother. What was your grandmother like, her mother, your mother's mother?
Yeah, my grandmother was somewhat of a coarse woman. She didn't speak much English, and so we weren't able to communicate very well. And she wasn't what I associate with most grandmothers that has become sort of popularized by the movie Minari. But for me, grandmothers were, you know, women that baked and, you know, were very soothing type women. But my grandmother loved to drink, loved to smoke, loved to gamble, would frequently employ this this thing called dongchim, which in Korean means poop needle. And when I was a kid, I had no idea what she was doing. But, you know, every time I sort of turned around unsuspecting, she would poke me in the butthole. And as a child, I was just terrified of this and was very much what I associated with my grandmother. And she was just, you know, she was kind of a stern woman that I was very frightened of as a child.
Yeah. And yet you saw your mother, when her mother died, you saw this outpouring of grief from your own mother. Was that surprising, shocking to see that?
It was, because, you know, I was fairly young and, you know, I think that I had never seen my mother's emotions so unabashedly on display. And for me, I just really didn't understand this woman, because as a young child, she just seemed so frightening and kind of mean. And so I was like, why does my mom love this woman so much? And it was hard for me. You know, I think that a lot of children don't sort of realize that they're parents are real human beings until sort of later on in life. And it was hard for me to acknowledge in that moment that this was my mother's mother and that would sort of mirror something that I would go through sooner than I thought.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do want to get to that. You also write that when you were in Seoul visiting family, you write here, and I'm quoting, "I was pretty in Seoul." What do you mean by that?
Well, whenever my mom and I went out, you know, there would be a lot of old women that would sort of, come up to me and say, "Oh, she's so pretty. She has such a small face." And I think that, you know, Korean people just are curious about people who are mixed and like to see, you know, what that looks like. And so, you know, I remember growing up in Oregon, no one ever really commented on my appearance often. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, whenever I went to Korea, I was sort of, you know, thought of as this pretty little girl.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Michelle Zauner. We're talking about her brand new memoir. It's called Crying in H Mart. And she did spend some of her late adolescence and early adulthood living in Philadelphia, the Philadelphia area. And she's also performs under the name Japanese Breakfast. And we've been playing some music from her new album and an old album as well. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. In fact, you were living in Philadelphia when you got word that your mother had cancer, and a pretty serious cancer, and she was sadly sort of well into the cancer by the time it was diagnosed. As you said, she didn't really go to doctors. Help us understand what learning that news meant to you.
Well, 2 years before, her younger sister actually had passed away of colon cancer. And so it was really important to our family that she get a colonoscopy right after that. And so it felt like, you know, it was this thing that was in our family that we would have to look out for. But it felt like we were in the clear. And it sort of felt like lightning striking twice when we found out that she had a different type of GI cancer and that it was stage four. And then we knew how... you know, so we had an idea of what we had on our hands and that it didn't look good.
And you went back home to be with her and to cook for her. I mean, it's interesting that, you know, I don't know how directly she taught you to cook, but it was clear that the cooking for her was your way of really taking care of her.
Yeah, it sort of became, the ultimate sort of role reversal. And I think especially as an only child, there's this real fear and knowledge that this moment is going to come when you have to rise to this occasion and that you're going to be alone in it. And so for me, being able to cook for her sort of represented the ultimate form of caretaking. And I was also just so worried that, you know, she was going to wither away because she was already such a small woman that if she didn't sort of, you know, work to keep up her appetite, that we would be in big trouble.
Mm. What did she want to eat? What did you cook for her that gave her sustenance?
I mean, she didn't want to eat anything. And a big part of the book is the sort of failures that I experienced as a caretaker. And I think sort of what ultimately led me to learn how to cook Korean food later on was this sort of psychological undoing of what I felt to be was my failure as a caretaker. Because, you know, I was 25 years old and my mom had never really taught me how to cook Korean food. And on top of that, you know, a lot of Korean food is really vibrant. It's extremely spicy. It's really flavorful. It's scalding hot. And those were the foods that we loved to eat, and those were the foods that I grew up with. And, you know, when you're going through chemotherapy and everything tastes like metal and makes you sort of nauseous, you can't eat foods like that. So I wasn't really familiar with the types of Korean dishes that one should prepare when someone is ill. And it wasn't until this woman, Kay, this Korean woman who is an old friend of my mother's, came to live with us that I sort of began to learn about these dishes.
I mean, what a cruel disease for someone who loved cooking as much as your mother, right? To sort of lose your sense of taste and to lose your appetite on top of that.
Yeah, it was truly heartbreaking. And I felt like, you know, in writing this food memoir, it was really important to find all of the different ways that, you know, we can feel about food. And certainly there's a lot of joy about cooking and eating. But a lot of the memoir is also about what that looks like when you're sort of robbed of it and the sort of ugly side and the ugly relationship that we can have with food.
Your mother, your family decides essentially to go to South Korea to stop the treatment and to go, I guess, for her to go home. Take us, I guess, to that chapter. I know this was a difficult time.
Yeah, actually, that is definitely the most difficult chapter in the book for me. And even when I was rereading the audiobook, I was very nervous about being a mess through the whole process, and the only chapter that I cried through was that one. And I think what was so heartbreaking about it was this moment where, you know, she had just finished her second chemotherapy. We had, you know, decided that she was no longer going to continue because it didn't shrink the tumor. And it was a moment of us choosing living over dying, you know, where it was like, let's try to have this one trip to Korea where we can really enjoy ourselves in the sort of mess of what this disease has brought into our lives. And instead of it being this joyful time to spend with family and travel around, She got extremely sick and everything went wrong. And we wound up in the hospital for three weeks. And she went into septic shock there and almost died. And it was a sort of miracle that we made it out of there.
But as you said, you cried in I guess, writing and doing the audiobook for this as well. But do you regret doing this, taking her or going with her back to South Korea?
I think
did she need to be there?
I mean, I think that if we had known what would have happened, we wouldn't have gone. But, you know, at the time, it's like you have to hold out for hope, you know. And I was really surprised because, you know, I've noticed this about myself, and it's a very surprising thing about myself as a sort of, you know, morose individual. but I actually respond to crisis with tremendous diluted positivity. I think that that is my way of dealing with the unknown, and that was what we were doing, you know, because we had to hold out for hope, because if you don't, then, you know, it's a lot more depressing. So at the time, you know, of course we had to try. We had no idea how horrible it would wind up, but yeah, I mean, I don't regret holding out hope for her in that way and trying to give her a joyful experience before she passed away.
Well, you got married a couple weeks before she passed away.
Yeah, that was a really wonderful thing we were able to do together. And I thought I was so unique in doing that. And I've actually discovered that so many people do that. They throw together these impromptu weddings so their parents can be there. That's a really common thing. And I've heard instances where the parent doesn't make it. And I'm so grateful that my mom was able to be there before she died.
Well, Michelle, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, that's Michelle Zahner, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about her new book. It's a memoir titled Crying in H Mart. And it's about her relationship with her mother's death a number of years ago. It's about food. It's about identity. It's about family. And it's also about music. A lot of good stuff. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us. Any questions or comments? That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Do stay with us. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Michelle Zahner about her new memoir, Crying in H Mart. She's also a musical artist who records under the name Japanese Breakfast. Let me play another song, and this is from her 2016 album, Psycho Pomp, and it's called In Heaven. Let's give it a listen. And that's In Heaven, performed by our guest, Michelle Zahner. Michelle, what's this song about?
Oh, I wrote this song a year after my mother passed away. And I was, you know, sort of conflicted with this generation and my parents that would often say to me, your mom's in a better place. She's in heaven. And I just was, you know, longing to really believe in that as someone who's an atheist. And the song begins with the dog's confused. She just paces around all day. She's sniffing at your empty room. And that was about my childhood dog, Julia, our beloved golden retriever, who was, you know, my mom was her primary caretaker. And, you know, I just was heartbroken that she was very confused. She had no idea where my mom had disappeared to and would sort of just wait outside of her room and was very depressed during this time.
Sure. And I mean, dogs seem to have this special connection to our emotions, right?
Yeah. I actually took her to the vet shortly after my mom passed away because she had begun obsessively licking her paws. And I brought her to the vet, and the vet asked me, did she go through something recently? And I was like, well, my mom just passed away. And she was like, oh, she's grieving. So it was really wild to see that this animal had this sort of physical manifestation of grief in this way. And it was like so sad to learn this.
Like, you have been grieving, right, through your albums. And I'm assuming in part of this book is about moving through your grief or sort of living it or perhaps even reliving it.
Yes, that's my version of licking my paws.
Right, exactly. Michelle, I'd like to have you read one more section from the book. And this is you're with your mom and crawling into bed with her. And I just love this paragraph.
That night, lying beside her, I remembered how when I was a child, I would slip my cold feet between my mother's thighs to warm them, how she'd shiver and whisper that she would always suffer to bring me comfort, that was how you knew someone really loved you. I remembered the boots she'd broken in, so by the time I got them, I could go on unbothered, without harm. Now more than ever, I wished desperately for a way to transfer pain, wish I could prove to my mother just how much I loved her, that I could just crawl into her hospital cot and press my body close enough to absorb her burden. It seemed only fair that life should present such an opportunity to prove one's filial piety, that the months my mother had been a vessel for me, her organs shifting and cramping together to make room for my existence, and the agony she'd endured upon my exit could be repaid by carrying this pain in her place, the right of an only daughter. But I could do no more than lie nearby, ready to be her advocate, listening to the slow and steady beeping of machinery, the soft sounds of her breathing in and out.
I mean, that's just a beautiful, beautiful passage. And I'm just imagining for your mother what it was like to feel your adult body next to her in bed together.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, there's a line sort of later on in the book where my mother says, you know, you always used to cling to me, and here you are still clinging to me, you know. Mm. And that's something that will sort of stick with me forever.
So did writing this book help you sort of learn to love your mother in a way that maybe you couldn't or felt more difficult as a teenager or a child?
Definitely. I feel like I learned so much more about my mother's character and the way that she loved me through writing this book. And I think I was also able to learn how to sort of forgive myself for a lot of the things that I really regretted as an adolescent, looking back at our relationship in this sort of new lens.
Such as?
I think that I just realized that, you know, I think that a lot of adolescents sort of go through this experience of being sort of rotten, you know. And I think that I was able to understand that my mother and I were up against a lot generationally and culturally, and that it wasn't my fault, you know, and that I had this creative ambition and it caused a major rift in our relationship. And that was just a complicated thing that we went through and not something that I have to mourn, you know?
Yeah. I mean, do you wish your mother could read this book?
I absolutely wish, you know, I mean, obviously there's no way that this book would even exist if we hadn't gone through that. But I was telling a friend, you know, they were asking me what I would like from this book. And I can see my mother reading a book like this, written by someone else, and sort of chiding me in this way of, oh, I hope that if this ever happened to me, you would write a book like this about me. Because I would like people to believe, like, you know, this is a book about a daughter really loving her mother.
And was she able to really get a sense of your musical career? I mean, this was, you know, she died in 2014?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you were just kind of at the beginning, right?
Yeah, things were not looking good for me in my music career by the time that she passed away. And unfortunately, you know, she never got to see me become successful as a musician. And, you know, I think that that's part of the reason why I'm sort of able to forgive myself in a way. I think I just really knew that this was the path for me. And it's unfortunate that she never got to see that. But in some ways, I have to believe that she knows. You know, there's like this sort of suspension of disbelief in my you know, spiritual knowledge that she must know in some way. She's looking out for me.
Can I ask you about your father?
Sure. I mean, we don't speak anymore, yeah. Unfortunately.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, you write about the fact that you and your father really had a falling out, and are not on speaking terms. Do you think about him?
I do think about him. There's a tremendous amount of grief, you know, and it felt almost like a second parent dying. And there was just, you know, there was a real impending fear. My father and I were never as close as my mother and I. And, you know, we just couldn't find a way for our grief to come together in a way. And I think that that's a pretty common thing, actually, is that, you know, our grief just felt at odds with one another in this way that we weren't able to find a way to come together and cope with it.
Yeah. I mean, can you imagine finding a way in the future, or that's just too abstract to even think about?
I do hope so. I think it's just too difficult right now, and we're just in very different places in our life. But I do hope so in the future.
Tell us about Japanese breakfast and the sort of thinking behind the music that you perform now.
Well, Japanese breakfast started as a sort of side project. I had another band in Philadelphia called Little Big League, and started writing music as a side project before my mom even got sick. And then, you know, when I went back to Eugene to live with my parents, I put Little Big League on hiatus and was sort of stuck in Eugene for 6 months after my mom died. And started writing this record just from a place of urgency to sort of compartmentalize everything that had happened and sort of recount and, you know, just process what was going on. And so the first album, Psychopomp, was a real reflection of my mother's death and the grieving process. And I had no real ambition when it was released. It was pressed 500 copies I thought I might sell over the course of the next 10 years. And somehow, you know, even in the press release, we never admitted that this was a record about her passing. And, you know, because I've just been such an open book about all of this, the narrative quickly spread. And I think is a reason why this project began to resonate with a lot of people.
Yeah. And how different is it? I mean, it must be hugely different between writing a memoir of almost, what, more than 200 pages and a 4.5-minute song.
It's very different. I feel like writing music is so much more impressionistic, and you can write in fragments, and it's very intuitive. And there's so much, I don't know, I guess writing a book is just so much more heady, and it involves a tremendous amount of revision and many years of labor. There's no skipping steps in it.
No.
And I was maybe a little bit more cocky going into writing this book than I should have been. It was certainly a very humbling process.
You write about this this woman who's got she's a YouTube vlogger, Manji, and she cooks Korean food, and it sounds like almost like a surrogate mom for you.
Yeah, Manji is a Korean YouTube vlogger and someone I turned to during my grieving process about a year after my mom passed away. I was going to therapy in the city and spending $100 copay on therapy. Mm. And I just had this cold, hard look at myself after months of doing that of, you know, is this really helping, or would you rather just sort of take yourself out to a nice lunch and wouldn't that make you happier? And so instead of doing that, I started going to H Mart and buying all these groceries and learning how to cook through this YouTube woman. And that was actually the sort of seed of this book was, you know, an ode to this woman who helped me so much during this really hard time and really demystified the Korean cooking process for me and helped me reconnect with so many memories of my mother in the kitchen.
And you've obviously met her.
I have met her. She actually had me over for my 30th birthday, and she cooked bulgogi, and I got to try her kimchi, and she bought me a little cake, and she's been so warm and generous with me, and someone I'm very, very grateful to have in my life.
Let me read something that you write in this book about fermentation. You write, I had thought fermentation was controlled death. Left alone ahead of cabbage molds and decomposes, it becomes rotten, inedible. But when brined and stored, the course of its decay is altered. Sugars are broken down to produce lactic acid, which protects it from spoiling. Carbon dioxide is released, and the brine acidifies. It ages. Its color and texture transmute. Its flavor becomes tartar, more pungent. It exists in time and transforms, so it is not quite controlled death, because it enjoys a new life all together. And again, another passage I really liked. This fermentation process is sort of mysterious and scientific and mystical.
Yeah, and I think that obviously it's a real metaphor for memory in some ways, and how to engage with it. And I think for me, so much of this book is about taking, trauma and finding a way to, trying to move away from trauma. And in this way, having memory take on this new life altogether. I mean, so much of it is about learning to put in the work to shift memory into a more pleasant space, I think.
Yeah. Let's close things out. And we have some music from Japanese Breakfast. And again, our guest, Michelle Zauner. And this is a song called Be Sweet, and it's from her forthcoming album called Jubilee. And we will play that as part of our closing music. And it looks like we've got Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. For more information about Radio Times, you can go to whyy.org/Radio Times. And you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. And again, this is Japanese Breakfast, single Be Sweet from the forthcoming album Jubilee, which should be out in just a month or so. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen.